This is Solidarity News on Radio Labour.
This is a Radio Labour World Report recorded on Friday, April 24th, 2020. I'm Mark Boulanger. In the report this week, union lessons from the Ebola crisis need to be heard. How global unions are working remotely. The Labour Start report about union events and singing.
For every stitch of clothing someone sweats away unseen, while the tangled threads of justice unravel at the seams. From the slums of New York City to the streets of Bangladesh, 100 years of struggle.
This is Radio Labour. As the world confronts the COVID-19 pandemic, unions are urging governments to look at the lessons that were learned during the Ebola crisis of 2018. Unions warned about the outbreak months ahead of time and called for an end to the austerity which was exacerbating the problem. A few months after the Ebola outbreak, which was contained to mainly Western Africa, Public Services International, the PSI, made a presentation to UNCTAD, the main UN body dealing with trade, investment, and development issues. The PSI is the labor organization which represents national public service unions at the world level. PSI Assistant General Secretary Daniel Bertossa made the presentation to the UNCTAD conference.
When a government finds itself in the face of a shock, an unexpected shock, the ability of it to have built its resilience in advance impacts critically on the way in which it's able to deploy its resources and take action at that time. And to look at those crises circumstances without some deeper discussion about the systemic approaches leaves you a little bit unsatisfied. So allow me to make some specific points. The first is that there is a general need to build capacity to plan and coordinate in any crisis response. And that requires strong central government. And this is often attacked when times are good as bureaucracy or a waste of public resources. But the absence of that ability to plan and coordinate in advance is critical when a shock hits. Similarly, the ability to coordinate between a central government and local government is absolutely critical. And that often means for, in the developing world, a well-funded tier of local government. It is often the local circumstances that are critical. It's often the local knowledge that saves lives in the first few days of a natural disaster. It's often the ability to understand those circumstances that are critical. Yet too often we see municipal government underfunded, simply not receiving the transfers from central government because of a vertical fiscal imbalance. And it's critical. We saw it with Ebola. In West Africa, when we saw that in countries that had higher level of health investment but more fragmented health systems because they weren't centrally planned and controlled, their ability to deal with Ebola was much worse. We also saw that workers weren't involved. And I think the involvement of workers in your systems and in your government cannot be underestimated. Again, with Ebola, it was the workers through their trade unions who were trying to alert the global community to the Ebola crisis 3 months before it was acknowledged by the international organisations. And these workers through their unions knew about it because they were the organisations that had people dying in the most remote areas of Ebola-affected West Africa. And because these unions were not legally recognised, because these workers did not have trade union rights, often they were not being paid, they were simply ignored for 2 or 3 months. And that exacerbated the crisis because the basic premises of social dialogue simply were not in place in some of those countries. And similarly, the commitment. We had 600 of our members died in the Ebola crisis. The majority of them were not provided with basic protective equipment, were not paid for their work, were working unpaid, were denied their basic trade union rights. You can't buy that level of commitment. Those workers continue to work in the face of that adversity. You can't buy that through a market. You can't pay someone enough to do that. They continue to work because they had a commitment to the public good, and they were part of a public system that fostered that commitment.
Like all other labor organizations, the global unions are trying their best to represent their members while their staff work from home. For example, the International Trade Union Confederation has almost all its staff working remotely. The ITUC is the body which represents national union centers, such as the Ghana Trades Union Congress at the world level. Sharon Burrow, the ITUC's general secretary, was interviewed by Sari Parker of the World Economic Forum about the challenges of working from home.
Sharon, first off, could you tell us quickly where you are and what daily working life is like for you right now?
Well, I'm now working remotely at home in Brussels. So all our staff are working remotely, except those of our security team and the occasional IT dependency. But basically, it's a challenge now to manage, as everybody is, a global office of people in their own homes. And while we have the technology, it really does play up the opportunities, but also the costs and the potential risks of people being atomized from their place of work in 100%.
What have you found like the single toughest nut to crack in this situation?
Well, I think the first week was just the sheer intensity of making sure that not only we were dealing with an unprecedented crisis, but we were making sure colleagues were connected. While we're very lucky, really, to have a close-knit staff, I think the mental cost, the mental health cost of this crisis will play out in the months to come. So I think just making sure people are connected, that you stay in touch, is actually critical, but it's also a big slice of time. Mm-hmm. And those human interactions we take for granted on a daily basis, you know, passing someone in the coffee corner, having a quick briefing, you know, meeting people on the way to work, whatever the daily rhythm might be, you don't actually realise how efficient that interaction can be until you're trying to manage that remotely, because there's a lot more talking. I've counted at last count 10 different methodologies whereby people can connect with me, talk to me, seek answers. And in any one day, that's a big challenge. But I must say, I think for people with young children, this is an incredible time. Having been a parent and indeed a teacher, then I understand the challenge of basically we could be in a 4, 5, 6, 8 week school holiday period. So balancing work and family takes on a whole new realm of challenges. So some good things, but some incredibly worrying things about, you know, the world being basically shut down.
What can workplaces do to better support parents during this time?
Well, I think we have to think about how you provide a mix of work and parenting that works in each case. You know, where there are two parents, of course, then that perhaps a rostering of time with children, because the children matter as well. Their mental health matters. Their need for support and activity scheduling and just indeed attention is very important for their own health and development. So I think you have to be conscious that for parents, you can't have a 24/7 operation where they can actually be online, available to work, and particularly for us in a global organisation, then that adds additional challenges. But the human aspects of those issues must be front and centre. So people must feel the security to say, I can't work for these hours, I'm available for these hours. And then, of course, you have those of our staffs who are sick. We don't have serious cases yet, but we have people with symptoms and part of their day will often be fatigue if they're able to work. And so covering the work schedule for those employees is also very, very important.
Here with his report about union events is Labor Start correspondent Derek Blackadder.
Each day, Labor Start's volunteers collect hundreds of news items about the struggles of workers and their unions from around the world. Here's just a small sample of their hard work. Our top story sections included links to coverage of the rearrest of an Iranian union activist and leader in the lead-up to May Day, the start of the global mobilization for International Workers Memorial Day, and statements from the ITUC and global and national unions about their plans for a May Day in the shadow of COVID-19, including the virtual May Day that Labor Start, the International Trade Union Confederation, and the Global Union Federations are preparing. The big story about the pandemic's effects on workers this week was the crisis within a crisis being faced by millions of migrant construction, healthcare, and domestic workers. Originating in countries like the Philippines, Pakistan, and Nigeria, they have been left without an income by the pandemic. For the most part, they do not qualify for any social benefits in the country where they have been working and are unable to travel home. Unions in both their home countries and in the receiving countries are struggling to provide them with support and with the option of repatriation. Around the world, global unions are organizing coordinated actions against corporations like Amazon that are ignoring the health needs of workers in the rush to profit from the crisis. At the same time, the global union federations have been able to achieve global agreements providing frameworks within which national unions can negotiate safer workplaces and economic protections for workers. But employers and governments are also mobilizing. Under cover of the COVID-19 pandemic, governments from Canada to Honduras to Brazil to India to Australia are undermining labor rights. In Australia, employers may now propose alternative non-union collective agreements, and workers will have only 24 hours to decide whether to accept the concessions forced on them, all without the involvement of their union. As well, we are carrying too many stories about crackdowns on trade unions as governments take advantage of the attention the pandemic has been receiving to eliminate or to intimidate critics of their pro-business policies. One example of this being Hong Kong, where the General Secretary of the Hong Kong Confederation of Trade Unions has been arrested. Our current photo of the week is of Chilean trade union leader Barbara Figueroa. Comrade Figueroa has been awarded the prestigious Arthur Svensson International Prize for Trade Union Rights in recognition of her commitment as the leader of the CUT, Chile's central labor body, in fighting for social justice. Finally, today is the anniversary of the 2013 Rana Plaza disaster, when 1,134 Bangladeshi garment workers, most of them women, died and 2,500 were injured. The building collapse is believed to be the most deadly garment industry workplace mass murder in history. This is Derek Blackadder from Labor Start, reporting for Radio Labor.
Now here are the Low Tide Drifters with Every Stitch.
In New York's garment district, a century ago, flame swept through a sweatshop where young women came to sew. They tried to flee to safety, but they found the stairwells locked. Some perished from the smoke and fire, some fell on the hard sidewalk. Present day in Bangladesh, 11 stories high. Workers stand before the glass, how they wish that they could fly. Exit doors are locked up tight, and the air is full of screams. 26 will die today for the sake of cool blue jeans.
For every stitch of clothing someone sweats away unseen, while the tangled threads of justice unravel at the seams. From the slums of New York City to the streets of Bangladesh, 100 years of struggle, it ain't over yet. From the slums of New York City to the streets of Bangladesh, 100 years of struggle, it ain't over yet. No, 100 years of struggle, it ain't over yet.
That's it. International labor news you can use. You can find our features and daily newscasts at radiolabor.net. I'm Marc Boulanger. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about caring for each other through global solidarity.